You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Bannick.
Over the past few years, the ground rules of the global economy have been rewritten in real time. Tariffs and retaliatory tariffs. Questions about where goods come from and who should tax them. Companies redrawing supply chains not only for efficiency, but for security. And underneath it all, a quieter but decisive shift. The sense that globalization, at least as we knew it, is fragmenting into competing spheres. Nowhere is this more visible than in cross-border investment, especially in infrastructure. For several decades, China has been a key player, financing and building roads, railways, ports, power, and increasingly the technologies of a low-carbon future across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and beyond. These projects can be lifelines for growth and lightning rods for controversy. Supporters see connectivity, industrial takeoff, and long-delayed improvements in everyday life. Critics worry about debt sustainability, transparency, and who, in the end, really benefits. Since the pandemic, the picture has become even more complex. Some of the headline mega projects have slowed, while a different pattern seems to be taking shape. Smaller, greener, more targeted investments, greater sensitivity to a country's debt risks, and a push toward localization and value addition. Processing minerals, assembling components, and building the ecosystems that make manufacturing viable. At the same time, Chinese firms that once built almost exclusively with Chinese finance are now, in some cases, competing for projects funded by Western sources. In other words, the map is changing, not just where money flows, but how and to what purpose. This shift is happening against a wider backdrop of geopolitical rivalry and declining development aid. As great power competition intensifies, traditional donors are turning inward, and many low- and middle-income countries are left searching for new partners, new opportunities, and new sources of finance to meet their development goals. Old alliances are being redefined, and a new development landscape is emerging, one that blends cooperation and competition in very unpredictable ways. My guest today is Hong Bo, a professor in financial economics at SOAS, University of London. She has followed Chinese overseas investment for years, combining a clear grasp of the big geopolitical currents with careful attention to data, contracts, and incentives. Hong and I explore the post-pandemic shift in project size and sector, how sovereign risk influences investment decisions, the evolving mix of state-owned and private actors, and what localization could realistically mean for jobs and capabilities. We also discuss the politics of negotiation, how countries can strengthen their hand individually and as regions, and why transparency and institutional capacity matter as much as finance. As always, I really value hearing from you. Your thoughts, reactions, and suggestions help shape the show. And if you enjoy these conversations, please take a moment to share the podcast with friends, colleagues, and networks who might find it useful. This is Dan Bannick, and you're listening to In Pursuit of Development. Good morning, Hong. It's lovely to see you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
There's a lot of discussion these days, the geopolitical tensions, the tariff wars, and this whole idea of globalization is under strain. One of the countries that has been, you know, and I think there's consensus on in terms of benefiting the most from globalization is China, in terms of trade, investments. And I'm particularly interested in the kind of investments, particularly infrastructure investments, that China has been undertaking on the African continent. China's doing this also in Latin America, in Europe, but also in Asia. But let's talk a little bit about your views on how Chinese investments abroad, particularly, say, since the pandemic, have changed. And I'm asking you this because there's a lot of debate on whether these are useful for countries in the global south. Who are they benefiting? Are they creating debt traps? It's a very polarized discourse. So Let's start by your initial thoughts on how Chinese investments to the African continent are currently working and the extent to which they've changed in recent years.
So I think you mentioned the geopolitics at the beginning of your question. So I think probably this is an extremely important background for us to talk about the future of Chinese overseas investment, let's say infrastructure investment. So we have seen a lot of evidence recently that the cross-border trade and the investment are basically already divided along the geopolitical lines. So we have read some papers, particularly after this year, since the start of the new round of trade wars, we see a lot of diversion in terms of import sources, countries, and export destinations. And that is definitely the fact already. So people, some scholars are already arguing we are already there. We are in a situation where we see a lot of fragmentation. So given this background, we see the center of the competition is between the US and China. So that should have very important implications for Chinese investment. As you mentioned, China has been doing this for the past 20 decades. It's not only in the past few years, but there are some changes, let's say, I would say structural changes after COVID. Before COVID, we saw Chinese investment, particularly in Africa, was increasing. Let's say, I had a figure between 2005 and 2023, the growth rate, the average growth rate of Chinese infrastructure investment globally was about 13%. So that is a very big growth rate. But then I would specifically mention COVID. So after COVID, we saw some arguments, the discussions that people say we have seen declining of Chinese infrastructure investment, particularly immediately after COVID. But then we saw a little bit pick up after maybe from 2021, particularly this year. If you look at the new figures, there's a new report from, I think, Australian University, Griffith University, that they presented the new data that Chinese has invested a lot this year, only the half year of 2025 in Africa. So I think we are seeing the recovery of Chinese infrastructure investment, but we saw some changes in terms of the distribution of the sectors. For example, they are now focusing on energy sector, climate, environment related. So of course, metal, mining, and also technology sector.
This was, I think, a few years before COVID that President Xi mentioned in the UN General Assembly that a big priority is going to be climate and environment. And one of the signature decisions was to stop building coal-fired power plants outside China. And so while coal is still very important within China, outside China has stopped. But what I do see, Hong, one of the big trends is that those so-called mega projects, those big infrastructure projects in Latin America and in Africa, they are fewer now. You know, you don't have that big, huge investments. And I can think about several reasons why that has happened. One would be the fact that, you know, as I mentioned, there's a focus on, you know, much more green, clean. There's a focus on SDGs. But there's also a focus on small and beautiful. And I think some of this is based on the lessons that I think Chinese banks, Chinese policymakers have learned, that sometimes these big projects, these big loans, they're difficult for the host country to pay back. Rather than going to these big mega projects, China was going small, green, beautiful. But it's interesting what you say, that it's picking up again. So the question would be whether they'll come back with these big mega projects.
I have two things to mention. First of all, indeed, we have seen fewer mega very large scale and physical infrastructure investment. I mentioned one paper, we have one recent research in which we actually looked at the data globally, all countries, all BRI countries. And we found that actually after COVID, the Chinese infrastructure investments became very sensitive to sovereign risk. So when the country is very risky in terms of, for example, their public debt position, and they receive the fewer infrastructure investment, let alone the size. So that's one thing that after COVID, indeed, from Chinese side, they recognize that it cannot go on like that, because think about the breakdown of the supply chains. They cannot take their own equipment, materials, labor to the site anymore. And in addition, on the host country side, the sovereign debt problem has become more serious.
Indeed.
After COVID. So I think this is logically explains why we have been seeing fewer large-scale infrastructure investments. However, we have seen infrastructure investment in what you mentioned, the small green technology orientated. So I will recommend your audience to read a very big handbook, Euclid Handbook in Infrastructure Finance, which is edited by Professor Joshua Albert from Ghana Business School, in which I think they collected a lot of pieces of most recent research on infrastructure financing. So I have a chapter there in which I actually recommend it after COVID. It is the time for China to cut down the size of the infrastructure projects, but to localize them. Now you see Chinese private investors are coming to Africa. They are investing in the processing of resources rather than just the money, you know what I mean. So this is happening. You see quite a lot. You will see more private Chinese investors who are joining this investment, but they are not going to go to a country where there is no Chinese infrastructure investment. So they are coming to African countries, for example, where there are already a lot of infrastructure investment because they are so important to go to the next step. For example, industrialization, processing of natural resources, etc.
That fits really nicely with what I've observed in my field work. A few years ago, I was studying two projects in Nairobi. One was the railway project from Nairobi to Mombasa, and then there was a expressway that China has built from the airport in Nairobi to downtown. And very different projects. The railway project, very well known, but also controversial because it's a huge loan that Kenya has been struggling to pay back, and China refused to give an additional loan for a new phase, even though the Kenyan government wanted it. So that was a very different type of project, huge infrastructure project, the most expensive in Kenya's history. The other one, the expressway, was more of a build, operate, transfer project where a Chinese company was building it. They were operating it, getting the revenue, and then 20, 25 years later, they will hand it back to the local government. Two very different projects. But what you said just now is super important, because without the ecosystem around, it's very difficult for an actor, whether it is, and I notice this in terms of Indians or Chinese or anybody, they often say, the companies often tell me that we want to come where there are others. I mean, it has to be packaging and media or some other software. So it has that ecosystem. Without that ecosystem, it's very difficult to manufacture, which brings me to one of the big criticisms, of Indians and Chinese is that whatever is brought to the African continent or elsewhere is manufactured, or, you know, the typical criticism of China was that it brought its people, it brought its equipment, it built, it did not engage local labor. That criticism has been largely addressed, I would say. But when I talk to pharmaceutical companies in India or any Chinese big companies, they say, we want to manufacture, but either the ecosystem is absent or the market is too small for us to make a profit. What do you think about the potential for assembling, manufacturing stuff in African countries rather than just importing it? Maybe given the trade wars, this is going to be more important.
It is. So indeed, linking Chinese investment in Africa with the geopolitics, I would really argue, maybe it's a little bit controversial, I would argue, if you look at the historical economic connections between China and Africa, I probably would say the geopolitics will affect this part of connection less. Because think about Africa's future. If they already, you mentioned the ecosystem, China has been involving in African countries for the past 2 decades. How can they get rid of China due to geopolitics? So from economic perspective, China has to, you know, they will continue in any case. And now back to the manufacturing sector. I think China, when we talk about Africa, people are talking about industrialization, or they already done pre-mature industrialization, which should not be the case. But I think manufacturing is coming if African economies are moving forward, because think about the resources exporting, and there will be a lot of restrictions on resources exporting, and that's for sure. That will be affected from international trade point of view. But from investment perspective, you will see more and more, as I said, that either Indian firms or Chinese firms or firms from Middle East countries, that they have invested a lot already. So I think now is a competition in terms of technology. So who has the suitable technology that can be adopted by the local laborers, local firms? I think this is more important than, so who has the suitable technology? And you see a lot of EVs, you see a lot of environmental related technologies, and those are already ongoing in Africa.
In terms of the low-cost technology or low-cost innovation, this has been one of India's big selling points, saying pharmaceutical products like medicines, it's the generic medicines that India produces are cheap, affordable. Western medicine is too expensive. Now, by the way, this is going to be a big problem because Trump has just announced an additional 25% on Indian goods. And the pharmaceutical industry, which is heavily, the Indian pharmaceutical industry, which is heavily dependent on exporting to the US, is going to really struggle. So they will look for additional markets elsewhere. But India has historically been saying frugal innovation, cheap, you know, that is the attraction. And I would also argue, having studied Chinese investments in Africa for the last 15 years, before Belt and Road, by the way, China has always tried to adapt to local needs. And that has been one of the selling points because, you know, African policymakers would tell me that Chinese ambassadors understand us better than Western ambassadors. We want infrastructure, but the West stopped building infrastructure. China is the only one building infrastructure. On this show, Hong, some years ago, a friend of mine, Jude Moore, he was a former minister from Liberia, he said, there's so much criticism of the Belt and Road and Chinese infrastructure. That's fine to criticize, but you have to provide an alternative. And there's been no alternative. So going back to our earlier point, China has been there, as you said, rightly, for many, many decades, has really cultivated relations. There's a lot of relational power on the African continent. And there really, I don't see any alternative. There's no other country, not the European Union, not the United States, that is building infrastructure. And yet there's a lot of criticism. Some of it maybe is correct. However, I find that the Western criticism is often a bit one-sided and the debt trap is often highlighted. Now, it is true that a lot of countries are struggling to repay their debts and they have taken on quite a lot. What is your take on this debt trap problem? And related to that, we can also discuss the resource curse hypothesis. So first, are Chinese investment projects creating more debt for African countries? What do you find in your recent paper?
So there are two sub-literatures regarding Chinese investment in Africa. One is whether or not the connectivity created some growth effect. People agree on that. However, on the second debate is about the debt trap. So whether or not the Chinese has set up the debt trap purposely, I wouldn't agree that China has set up the debt trap purposely. I have examined a PhD student's PhD thesis recently, mm-hmm. which is about Chinese loans in Africa. So I still remember that figure. So on average, African countries who have received the Chinese infrastructure investment, their debt level is about 13% of their total debt, which is not as high as people can imagine. So I think we need a little bit, if people are arguing that there is a debt trap, but we need to look at the evidence. We have not seen the evidence, consistent evidence in supportive of the debt trap statement or hypothesis. So there is a nuance in terms of Chinese investment, and that is they signed the contract, but they have a kind of collateral. So they say resource for infrastructure, for example. So they send the contract and they ask the host country to export a kind of metal or resources to China for the next 20 years, and then as a way of paying back the debt. And now there are some other varieties of, for example, taking over the management of a port or taking over the project for some years. And then after some years, they will return this to the host country government. So I think there is a variety of that. I'm not saying everything is perfect, but in one of my recent paper, our recent paper, actually, we argued that, for example, if African countries, if a host country does not have a capacity to set up, to build the infrastructure facilities themselves, they have to borrow. But they have no other alternatives to borrow apart from borrowing from China. And then even borrowing from China, they do not have payback facilities. So China agreed that we can sign a contract to pay by, for example, resources. So this is also related to the resource curse problem. In a research, we argue, actually, if this is the way that African countries can get some much-needed infrastructure, and if the infrastructure can promote or help economic performance or growth, I would say this may be the second best choice, but there is no other choice. So I think overall, in the longer term, we would see the benefits that this infrastructure investment has created to African economies.
On the first point, you're right, because I don't remember the exact figure. Most of the debt is actually in African countries is owned by non-Chinese actors.
Exactly.
It's the MDBs, it's the Western actors that hold most of the debt. China does not hold it. So that's one thing. The second thing is also, I would support the idea that China does not knowingly go into trap countries. China has better things to do. I mean, it's just silly to think that they are trying to trap countries. But what I have been arguing over the years is that China must learn from some of the mistakes it has made. whether it is Venezuela, whether it is Kenya or wherever, I sometimes feel that China has, or Chinese policymakers or banks, etc., have been too eager to listen to the host country leaders. When they come and say, please build us this, they say, okay, okay. Rather than sort of having an exchange of ideas and do you really have public backing? Can you afford it? Are you sure you want this? China has, in my view, often highlighted this non-interference policy, which makes it unable to ask too many critical questions, to do the homework, which means they say yes to building something that later turns out to be problematic, as was the case in Kenya, when the government does not have the money to pay back. So the viability of projects, I think now China has become much better. That is what we were talking about earlier, Hong, that after COVID, those big projects are fewer and far between. One is trying to build something that is more viable. But going back to the debt issue, one argument, of course, is that the big motivation for China in African countries is resources, oil, minerals. Mm-hmm. But there's also another argument for building infrastructure in Africa or even in Latin America. It's the diplomatic tool. It is solidarity. This is the narrative I hear from Chinese foreign ministry officials saying, we don't really have to do it, but we're doing it because of friendship. What is your view? Is it profit? Is it profit seeking? Or is it also a bit of this solidarity?
Very good question, Dan, and observation as well. So I think if you look, we did check the data actually. So where China has invested globally, let's say, in our recent book chapter, we found that China invests in a country not based on the country's institutional system, the political risk. That's not the concern for Chinese, particularly infrastructure investment. And then you know that for those infrastructure investment, the contractors are mainly, majority of them are Chinese state-owned enterprises. So therefore, if you think about the motivation of a government, so there is a state capitalism theory, and which predicts that they invest in somewhere, not necessarily for short-term profit, but for long-term, maybe geopolitical position in the future. As you mentioned, the diplomatic connection. So therefore, we found that when the Chinese investment is not really directed to the country that has a very good institutional setup. So that probably answers your question. In the longer term, yes, you see the benefit, which probably cannot be measured by profit. But within the short run, probably you do not see any economic benefits. So I think now the research is coming, and including our own. So we are investigating, in fact, what are the economic benefits for China of doing so? And for Chinese, let's say firms, if they, even though they are state-owned firms, but they should start somewhere to be concerned about profitability of doing so. But it's a mixture of both. So we need to look at, for example, 3 years after they invested in the infrastructure.
You know, one new trend I see in some African countries is that some of the big Chinese firms like CRBC, they are now increasingly trying to get contracts from Western sources of funding to build projects. Because China has logistical infrastructural capacity, often the Western actors want something done, either through foreign aid or some investment, and then they can contract these firms, these Chinese firms that are well established, like in a city like Nairobi. But, you know, there's another reason why I feel that this debate has been polarized. One thing I mentioned is the lack of homework, that one does not necessarily look at the ability to repay, but also the extent to which an idea, a project, a demand is anchored in the population. Because Chinese officials often negotiate with the host country officials. They're not necessarily doing the political homework. And what sometimes happens, as you know, Hong, is that when there's a change in government in one of these host countries, some of these opposition parties are often criticizing China. But of course, when they come to power, they are again becoming friends. But that creates a bit of a tension. A final thing I will say that has created a lot of tension is the lack of transparency, which is not necessarily just the Chinese fault, because it is often the host country government that insists on these clauses. And then the Chinese firms tell me, but, you know, we don't have a problem talking about it, but it's the host country. But that creates mistrust or distrust. And local populations are wondering, why are they building this? You know, who's paying for it? And even if a project is being built without a loan, still people are wondering, oh, I'm sure that we are paying for it in some way. So I think greater clarity, openness is needed. And I think there's already some movement from Chinese firms in that direction in terms of PR, etc. But, you know, it's still a different culture, right? I mean, you can't expect Chinese firms to be as, open about these things as other firms are.
I completely agree. So, and that's why the change of leadership is a part of an institutional arrangement. So is there any legal regulations or legal rules that can guarantee that it's not that person, it is the system that matters. And in addition to that, you mentioned, you know, this transparency issue is also partially an element of institutional setting up. So it's all the laws and regulations of the host country. So therefore, you reminded me of a sub-literature in which actually a group of people, they actually focused on the agency problem.
Exactly.
And within host countries. So it's governance issues, it's institutional issues. So yeah, I think we are talking about the same thing. But those are the two things that you mentioned that indeed are very important observations.
And some of my colleagues, even those who've been on this show, have argued that what one really needs in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, is greater negotiating capacity. Because China is the big brother, the big actor. So it's always China-Africa, but maybe it should be more Africa-China. And we see this in some of those, you know, Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, FOCAC meetings, etc. That language is changing, but the agenda is still set by China. So maybe some of this agency issue actually has to come from the institutions, from these host institutions themselves, where they better articulate the needs and demands. You know, it's like pitching an idea. Like, look, this is a project. Most people want it. We have the money. Here's the collateral. This is how we plan. You know, making it sellable rather than just saying this is a vanity project. I want a stadium in my name because I'm the president. I have to build a university in my backyard. You know, those things, I think, you know, were some of the problems in the past. But I think doing that bit of that homework will help. But in terms of negotiating repayments, that's another thing, you know, that has been very controversial, that there's always a media report, oh, China is taking over a port, China is taking over an airport. But none of that has actually happened. But the media is full of those stories in Sri Lanka, Hambantota, in Entebbe Airport, in Uganda. But what I do notice is that when I talk to World Bank officials, I've talked to Justin Yifu Lin, the current chief economist of the World Bank, they all say that I think both China and Western institutions have to be quicker at negotiating to, you know, for debt repayment or debt relief. Going forward, how can China better help countries that are already struggling? Because China's not really demanding anything back, but it's like, you can pay me in the future. So how should African policymakers negotiate in these situations?
First of all, in terms of the bargaining power, yeah, right, of the African host countries, it is very difficult. Think about infrastructure technology. Who has the technology? China. And then a feature of Chinese infrastructure investment in those developing countries is that they bring in finance, together with the construction. So those are the two things that I do not think the host country, particularly in Africa, they can do without China. So therefore, they are in a weaker, in my view, they have been in a weaker position in negotiating. So for example, they may not dare to request that the Chinese investor, you need to be localized. You need to use our local labor. You need to use our local suppliers, you know, to your project. I actually looked at Chinese infrastructure in Central Asia as well. Mm-hmm. So I found that the level of localization there is much higher. So China adjusted depending on bargaining power, local requirement. So I think, again, it is difficult, but I think, yes, we need to find Chinese African host countries. They do need to improve their institutional arrangement, and they need to find some special thing that they can enhance their bargaining power. So, for example, natural resources. If you can process natural resources, which is related to industrialization, then probably you have much more bargaining power because you do not need to sell or export your resources, raw resources. So you have the value added before you export them. So I think it's really down to the development, the industrialization, manufacturing. I'm a manufacturing person. I think no matter how much service you have, if there is no manufacturing, I do not see that you can fly in the sky with a lot of fancy services. So you need to be grounded from manufacturing, and particularly, I always say, particularly for African countries.
You know, there's also another element to this in terms of the bargaining power, the negotiating power, and that is for the African continent. If you think about, there are some countries that are big and powerful and have bigger economies, and then there are some countries like Malawi, one of my favorite countries where I do a lot of work, which does not have that kind of an economy. The bargaining power is even lower. So one idea that I know of a lot of people are talking about increasingly is Africa, or the African continent, negotiating as a bloc, not just as individual countries, but as this group of so many countries together, and that the bigger economies should have some sort of responsibility for negotiating on behalf of smaller economies. That's where the African Union should come in. But the African Union, in my view, has not been very effective. So again, going back to institutions, you know, so maybe there's also a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, indeed. So this is also, Dan, what you mentioned is also related to the current, you know, fragmentation situation. So if everything, the economic activities is fragmented, then the regional thing will become much more important. Either it's regional trade integration or investment, regional cross-border investment. And also, you mentioned the African Union, the bargaining power is probably need to build up by working together, such as ASEAN countries, you know. So, yes, I agree. Those are the things that I think there are a lot of things that they should really, really build up from inside the host countries.
As we started this conversation on talking about how every day we are being bombarded with new information about tariffs and the origin of goods and where to tax them, and some of the concerns that people have in Africa elsewhere that the Chinese economy itself has slowed down since COVID, and that the attention for Chinese policymakers may be elsewhere. You know, some people, I've had trade economists on the show saying that China's market is so big that China does not really have to trade. It can just focus on domestic consumption. But those things worry countries on the African continent. Because if China abandons Africa, I wouldn't say abandons, but let's say scales down drastically in terms of its infrastructure investments, its investments in general, then there is really still no other main actor that can fill in. And now in this day and age with reduced aid, foreign aid is being drastically cut. US aid has been dismantled. Many European countries are cutting back. There is really very little finance available. So if you could think about the next 6 months or a year forward, where do you see Chinese investments, not just in Africa, but in Asia, Latin America? Do you see any trends? Do you predict any change, or will it just continue as you referred to in that last report? It has actually increased. Maybe China feels greater responsibility to fill in the gap when the US and many others are pulling out.
So that's a very good question. And I think, and obviously it is difficult to predict, but you started with this question. You started from Chinese domestic economic problems. I do not think there will be serious problem, to be honest. So we have heard a lot of stories, but for me, we have seen so many ups and downs. And even with this tariff, the competition between the US and China, I do not see that China's export and investment are going to be affected very, very profoundly. In terms of whether or not China is going to invest overseas, I would say yes, but maybe there are more private enterprises rather than the majority of the investors are related to the government. But I have to say, in the critical strategic sectors, China will invest more, will continue to invest. So if you look at the regional distribution recently, it is about Central Asia, maybe Middle East areas, and some African countries. It depends on what they are invested. So they are invested in the strategic. So for example, something that is very important for the global supply chain. So China will continue to do that. So I'm sure about that. And I wouldn't say everything is going well in terms of domestic economy. We have heard consumption problem. We have heard, but China has invested, has been focusing on technology sector, energy sector. So I think we will see they are continuing investing in those areas. They do not really it's not really their responsibility to take care of a particular host country, but they have their strategy as well. And the government, the Chinese government, probably will organize the resources to guarantee that they can continue to invest in the critical areas.
Hong, it was lovely seeing you and talking with you on the show. Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
And thank you, Dan, for your very interesting discussions and for the platform to discuss this issue, which is very important. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.